Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important films and contemporary classics. My name is Chris, and I'm joined, as usual, by my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And we have watched Jean Renoir's much-adored 1939 film, The Rules of the Game.
Much-adored?
Much-adored. You see, I slipped a little bit of French in there,
oh.
Just to try and...
That's impressive.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's much adored now, but it wasn't when it first came out.
Yeah, no, we can get into that. We'll save that, like, for
later
on. But, yeah, yeah.
Well, we should do a synopsis.
Mm.
I will not do the synopsis this evening.
God damn it.
Because the film is like a murder mystery almost in the kind of interrelationships between characters.
It kind of gets into a bit of an Agatha Christie-esque, like, interweaving story,
yeah.
Like characters and
yeah.
Interplay and stuff. Actually, no, fuck that. I'd say correct Agatha Christie for like an Oscar Wilde-y kind of thing a little bit. So it tells the story of... Oh, good Lord.
That's right. There's several characters.
Yes. All right, let's see how I can do with this. There's a woman named Christine who is married to Robert, and Christine is the object of affection for Andre, who has just flown solo across the Pacific,
mm-hmm.
Was it? Yeah,
yes.
Like doing a Charles Lindbergh-style flight. And to kind of appease and like work out like where everyone stands within this relationship, they go away. They have a group of people that all go away to a country estate for a weekend hunting and things, and there we get to meet more additional characters, including Shoemaker, the sort of game warden-y groundskeeper guy, Lizette, who is Christine's kind of handmaiden, who is also married to Shoemaker, whole cast of characters, and the film is a giant kind of meta-examination of life, love, infidelities, relationships, both personal, professional, and how people conform to those and how they all kind of co-mingle and interrelate and kind of mirror each other.
Yeah, class struggles.
And, yeah.
There's a lot going on. That's not bad.
Thank you.
That's not bad,
okay, on that note, I want to look up what the IMDb, like their like one sentence plot synopsis is.
Yeah. It's going to have things like social rules and...
A bourgeois life in France at the onset of World War II as the rich and their poor servants meet up at a French chateau. Yeah, okay, like that's real, like without getting into character specifics.
It's a great synopsis, that one sentence.
Yeah, they nailed it.
I wish we could do that.
Yeah, we waffle too much, but what can you do?
I'm not a professional. All right, anyway, let's get into it.
Yeah.
So, should we talk about character by character in this instance, or should we talk about more the cinematographic aspects of it?
I think if we start cinematographically and then the characters will kind of come out from that, because I fear if we go character by character, we'll end up kind of getting lost in the weeds
muddled
a little bit. Yeah,
precisely.
Yeah. Just like right off the bat, like what was your initial thoughts on this film? Because...
Okay.
Like, I'll preface that with saying, like, I approached this one knowing that it was considered, like, a masterpiece of cinema and things, and I knew nothing about it. All I knew is that we'd done Renoir's episode one of this show with The Grand Illusion.
Yeah.
And he's a very interesting visual filmmaker.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I had no idea other than it's supposed to be a masterpiece.
Yeah, that's what I heard. I was going into it thinking this is one of the best films ever made.
Mm-hmm.
But when I mean, I'm always kind of...
You're on your back foot, like, just kind
well,
of...
When it's an old film, you have to try and put... I find that you have to try and put yourself in the shoes of people watching it for the first time in an era which you never... It's hard for you to connect with.
It's the problem of, like, being a modern audience and, like, you know, people born in the 80s, where, you know, we grew up with stuff like... That it's Star Wars, bombastic, like... like, you know, we're products of the Michael Bay era of cinema.
Yeah.
And then you get something that's just, like, slow, methodical pace that it can...
Well, but even drama, I mean, yeah, cinema's come such a long way to make... I mean, that being said, there's no... like pacing issues or anything. Anyway, my point is I had mixed feelings by the end of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I was scratching my head and thinking, why is this considered a masterpiece? And why is this such an important film?
Yeah.
When I'm going away from it thinking, I mean, it's a pretty good drama and there's definitely some fascinating filmic work, but what's really going on?
What's actually jumping out and making people consider this a masterpiece?
So I think that having watched it, only when I went into detail reading a few, you know, bits and pieces.
Reading up and trying to actually analyze the film. That's right. Yeah.
Then it started to just really warm to me.
Yeah.
So I think this film, is this the same for you?
Yeah. Oh, very much so. Yes. Yeah,
I think this is the situation. If a modern audience is watching this film, I think it, you have to get a little bit dirty and work a bit hard.
Yeah.
To really get the most out of it. Having said that...
I would say similar to, like, say, a Tarkovsky film, like Solaris, where we were watching that, like, we know this is supposed to be good, like, and there are elements of it that are fucking fantastic, but, like, you have to work to get to the nuts and bolts of, like, why it is a masterpiece and why it is...
That's right. That. And I think the reason... Let's go into this, because I think we're going to cover a few things just by discussing this.
Mm-hmm.
I think that at the time when it came out, it's... talking about the upper class.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty candid in that regard.
Oh, very much so.
Right? So it's painting the upper class as, in some ways, very similar to the working class.
Oh, that's 100% what I get, like, from the two opening scenes alone.
And at the time, it was controversial, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the upper class don't want to see themselves like that.
They consider, like, that's why they're, like, you know, they think they're better and hoity-toity and yada yada. Yeah,
and so from my point of view, it's not a big deal. I mean, even the upper class of today would think, like, who gives a shit? Everyone is.
And it's also a theme that's been explored multiple times in art and cinema and literature and things throughout our lifetime. So
it's confrontational at the time, but not so much now.
Yeah, and so we, like I said, as a modern audience, you're sitting there watching it, just being like, yeah, I get, like, yeah. This is something that has been analysed before,
And why is this such a big deal? But of course,
context and frame of, like, precise time and place and things. On that note, like, that was the one thing, like, I very much got initially from the film. Like, the film opens with Andre landing at the airport after completing his solo flight, and it's a weird way to kind of start the film, because you're like, wait, what is this?
Yeah,
and he acts like a petulant child because Christine is not there to meet him, and he's like, well, I did this all for her, meh, meh, meh. And he gets kind of Octave, who is his kind of, like, a kind of conduit between these two worlds of the upper and lower class and things, his friend, weirdly played by Jean Renoir. He sort of hauls him up and is just like, you're acting like a little dick. Like, understand, like, you're not acting like a hero in this upper class kind of, what, you're not acting how you are supposed to be acting. You're acting kind of immature and lower class.
I think to the point, it's he's not following the rules of the game, right?
Exactly.
There's the social rules that one should follow, given that he's a working class person. And
so there in that opening scene, you're having someone who is an upper class kind of and newly formed national hero who is acting out of his class. And then in the very next scene, we cut to Christine getting ready for a night out with her husband, Robert. And she's putting on her makeup and getting ready and things. And she is sitting at a kind of console table full of mirrors. And you don't see Christine in the mirrors. Reflected in the mirrors of the console is Lizette, mm-hmm. her lower class handmaiden. So it's like you are seeing, instead of the upper class person reflected in there, you're seeing the lower class. Like, it's automatically he's establishing upper is lower and lower is upper in this film. Like, we're just obliterating these lines and we're going to draw these kind of parallels.
Yeah, I think that's the major point of the film, right?
Yeah, and he's established it within the first two scenes. But that, like, leads me on to, like, okay, so Renoir is established, like, we've established, like, what he's going for, like, in terms of, like, a message and, like, an overall kind of statement. How do you and, like, it's very clear the way that he's constructed it visually, through editing and his blocking and performances and everything is phenomenal. Narrative that it's housed in, how do you feel about that?
I think that it's rather slow.
Yeah.
I mean, it took me... The film's an hour and 40 minutes, mm-hmm. and I felt the first hour.
Yeah.
It was quite slow to start, so...
And even when it essentially starts cooking, I guess, like, towards that, like, when you've got, like, the chase sequences in the house and, like, the weird, like, kind of cat-and-mousiness of it all, I was getting the sense... Again, this is the whole thing of, like, you need to dig deeper in this film and, like, look a little... I was like, yeah, this is just kind of, like, like why I mentioned Oscar Wilde earlier. It's like, yeah, it's just a farce,
mm-hmm.
but like it's the statements he's making, I think, are not necessarily housed in the best narrative, but I don't think that's why he wanted to make the film, which is kind of what I'm leading
this
towards.
What do you mean by that? Because
I think he, like, the narrative is, it's fine, but like, I'm meaning like the base thing of like, you know, the she's in love with him, but he's in love with her, and blah, 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 blah.
But I think that serves a purpose because...
Yes, that's what I mean. Like, the narrative is kind of... not rudimentary, but it's kind of base, so he can then experiment visually with trying to tell that story versus trying to tell it in the more traditional way of just through...
Plot point, plot point, plot point.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, he goes to the nth degree trying to do the blocking.
Yeah.
Trying to set up that there's these... the classes, I mean, if you're in a mansion and you've got a shot, there's always going to be these depths of field that is within the camera shot that is describing people's positions in the hierarchy of a social system.
And it's always fore, middle, back, and it's always interplaying and people swapping their positions throughout scenes and where they're positioned, and it's a goddamn masterpiece.
Yeah.
But that's a weird thing on an initial viewing, unless you know it's there and you're looking for it to kind of get, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and certainly, let's say this. At the end of the film, I started YouTubing, and I came across, and you were saying just before we were recording that you did the same thing, I came across a 10-minute or so video made by Wolf Crow.
Wolf Crow, a really great YouTube channel.
And if you want to have a look at how this fellow describes the blocking, it's fucking sensational
video. Yeah.
And I gotta admit, I watched that video and I go like, huh, I wasn't picking up on that during my viewing. So the intelligence of the film is kind of lost on me until I started digging deeper
and start analyzing it on all of these kind of cinematographic level. That's not even a word. You know what I mean? Just like, you know, cinematic levels.
So I mean, that's okay. That's all right. That's not a problem.
Do you think that's like, and now I'm jumping ahead to something I have info on later, but do you think that's why the film wasn't received well when it first came out? Because it is such a kind of, it's working in a sphere that audiences weren't necessarily used to.
It's too nuanced.
Yeah, yeah. And it's...
No. Because if you don't pick up on it, you don't pick up on it, right? Mm. But the question is, are you engaging with the main characters and their relationships?
Mm-hmm.
For me, certainly toward the second half of the film I was, because, I mean, the first half, however slow, does take the time to set up everybody's characters properly.
Yeah.
And I think that the reason why it was thought to be so shit when it first came out is only because people were like, we can't fucking watch the upper class.
Okay, so based on like the actual social commentary, they weren't happy with all of that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean the film is shot in such a way that it's almost like a documentary fly on the wall kind of thing. Like there is totally a cinematic flair to it.
Oh yeah.
But I mean, thank you very much. Given the context that no one had really made a film that was so candid with people's lives and the way they thought, they're talking about mistresses, they're talking about affairs.
Yeah, infidelities and things. Yeah.
That's right. So at the time, that shit is pretty taboo.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, everybody's...
Yeah.
The point is that every... I mean, this is what's so great about the film is no matter whether you're upper class or working class, master or servant, everybody's basically playing the same game.
And yes. That
is, I mean, they even mention, like, you know, everyone's got to have... Everyone has affairs.
Yeah. Everyone plays the game and you've... Like, yeah, it's just when... Unfortunately, like, essentially what ends up happening in the film is that people start to bend and eventually break the rules of what has been, quote-unquote, established for this game, and that's when everything kind of falls apart.
I think, yeah,
and it's super interesting towards the end. Like, where did, like, you said, like, the first half kind of dragged for you. When did it start kind of picking up, like, your engagement?
Once the characters were established and you got their motivations and it was clear what they were going after...
Yeah.
Then I was really engaged in just having the film follow through with that.
Yeah, you're invested at this point because you know who the players are and you want to see how the game essentially unfolds, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good... This might be the best framework for this podcast right now, is discussing whether we can go through each character and figure out whether they broke the rules or not.
That's actually... Yeah, I like that idea, actually. So, yeah, going character-wise is probably better.
Yeah, I mean, because that's the point of the film. Mm-hmm. They all have their own conclusions. So, Robert, the owner of the mansion, the big wig.
The husband, essentially. The husband of Christine. Yes.
He has had an affair for 3 years since the beginning of his marriage.
I think he was... what's the name of his mistress again?
Someone says Jay.
Yeah, I'm forgetting. Not Genevieve, but it's something like that, yeah.
Jackie? Or
yeah. I don't know. Apologies, listeners. Anyone who's like... Someone's screaming into their like headphones right now.
I don't have that on my... On my grid of...
On your little cheat sheet. It's, because there's, like, the big scene where he's just like, I need to stop this and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But they've been, like, sleeping together from pre-Christine days, so, yeah.
Yeah, but he doesn't want to break the rules of causing tension between him and his wife. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's best to keep the secret. And that might be, that kind of decision would be made in any home, whether you're an upper class or lower class. But he's certainly trying to not create drama.
Yes.
Which is, I hate saying it, but an upper class thing to do, right?
And it's also...
Being proper, let's say.
Yeah, down even to the point of inviting Andre out to their chateau for the weekend to go hunting and hang out with them to essentially clear the air as to all of what's been going on.
So he's following the rules that he considers to be part of...
proper behaviour.
Yeah, the game for upper class... masters.
Yeah, and I think very specifically we need to point out upper class men.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's like the big thing where it's okay for a man to like have an affair as long as it's kept on the DL. Like, it's just like, yeah.
That's the rules, yeah.
Yeah, that's the rules, I guess, which is just shitty.
Now Andre, who is the working class fellow who is very interested in Christine, announces, you know, his love and blah, blah, blah towards Christine, which is against the rules.
Because he's acting, like, not being reserved, I guess.
Well, it's interesting that if he was upper class, he could announce, he might have...
But he's wearing his passion on his sleeve, whereas that's very
But
like,
it is something that... Again, I feel bad about saying this, but it is something that a working class person would tend to do because this doesn't feel right.
Oh, no, it is, though, because you have the mirror version of that in Shoemaker, who is a man who, working class man, who has his love tested and flies out headstrong with his emotions.
Okay.
So that's what I mean. Like, you've got all these parallels within the kind of core six characters that all mirror each other in different ways. And,
okay. And Shoemaker is... husband to Lisette, who is the servant of Christine.
Yes.
And Marceau, who is a man that was found poaching. This is why it's so hard to do a synopsis.
Yeah, there are so many.
Marceau is a man who was found poaching rabbits in the mansion's grounds. And he is interested in Lisette, who mirrors Andre interested in Christine.
Yep.
Who
is, married to Shoemaker. Like, it's all like this upper... There's literal parallel of the three in the three with the upper and the lower.
It's very complex.
But... Throughout that, though, you have those intermingling of kind of reflections of alter people, I guess. Like, I would say, like, honestly, I would liken Marceau closer to Robert than I would to Andre in terms of type of character and how he presents himself.
Yeah.
Whereas Shoemaker, I think, is more Andre to me, which is like that weird kind of reversal within, like, the parallel.
Well, they all know their place. Mm-hmm. Schumacher's getting frustrated with Lisette because she seems to be... very eager at
not wanting to be with him.
and also flirting with other men, which is against the rules. But Lisette is one of the most interesting characters because she's almost like she wants to be married to Christine. You know, she's so infatuated with making sure that Christine is looked after. Even at the end when she's like, you know, what am I ever to do?
Yeah.
Well, I will not live with my husband. I will not live with Marceau. I will live...
I'm here to you, so that's
part of, like, I mean, for her the rules are the master takes precedence over everything.
There's a lot going on. Yeah.
So I think we've covered. Is that like covering the? Is that covering all of the character
in like relationships? A vague-ish kind of way, I guess. Yeah.
I think that's another reason why I struggled a bit, because it is somewhat difficult to try and keep tabs on everybody.
You've literally drawn a graph and like this diagram of everyone's like interconnecting relationships and everything. Yeah, it is. It's a little tricky on like an one viewing kind of to nut this one out, but performance-wise, like you mentioned, like Lizette is probably the strongest character. Do you think that's like for you? Was that because of who and what she was as a character, or the performance? Because for me, it was
the performance.
Yeah, she was the most magnetic. Both, yeah,
it's both, but yeah, her performance was so fucking amazing.
I would say the two people that whenever they were on screen, I was just glued was Lizette and Octave, who is Jean-Manuel. Like. Mm-hmm. Those two characters, and I think it might be because they're the two main ones that straddle the lines between the two classes.
Sure.
And, like, kind of freely flow between them and work to manipulate and change the game, I guess. Like,
sure.
Yeah, that just made them more interesting, whereas Robert, Christine, and Andre and things, and Schumacher and Marceau, they're just playing the cards they've been dealt, if that makes sense.
Yes. They're following their own motivations to their conclusions, but...
But they're not actively seeking to manipulate or change the situations around them, like Octave and Lizette.
Okay, I know what you mean. Okay. Yeah. So, certainly Octave is probably the most nuanced of all the characters, mm-hmm. because he is, as you said before, the glue between the masters and the servants.
Mm.
And I think it's fascinating that Jean-Renoir said, I'll play that.
Yeah, and he does it so well.
Yeah, has he done... any other performances before?
I'll just quickly look up. Or? Yeah, I wasn't too sure.
Because I wasn't aware that it was him until halfway through watching. I was kind of reading up a little bit here and there. And
yeah, he acted a bit, mostly in a few of his films. Le Bête Humaine, Rules of the Game. Like, yeah, he's got like 12 actor credits on IMDb. Like, nothing major, but yeah, a few.
He's no slouch.
Yeah, a few little bits and pieces here and there.
Yeah, so he's childhood friends with Christine, and that's what glues him to that world, and he happens to be friends with Andre, so that's what glues him to.
He's an interesting character because he seems to be wanting the best for everyone while, and he's manipulating people in that way, but not for seeming, like, selfish reasons. Like, he just kind of wants...
He's putting his ego aside.
To try and help the people around him.
Because towards the end, it comes out that he's actually in love with Christine, which, I mean, you could reason the whole way through the film that that's kind of obvious, but...
But it's... And that's, again, him not trying to break the rules because he's brother-sister relationship with her, and that's not how that goes.
Or, I mean, like, if he was childhood friends, maybe there was it was taboo to have him... playing with the rich girl, quote unquote.
Mm.
Potentially, I don't know. Like, that's not explained in the film,
that's just circumstantial. But yeah,
this requires multiple viewings.
It does. Was there any point in the film where you were just like, okay, I get why this is considered so highly. Like, was there any kind of moment where you're like, all right, I need to sit up and pay attention here?
Okay. I there's probably a checklist, actually, we can go through a little dot point. Because I was very surprised to see a dolly being used in the film.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Especially in the last sequences of the film where the movement of the characters throughout the mansion is so erratic and vibrant.
So, but that's like a very assured thing to do when you've got your characters who are being so manic and... kind of causing chaos and running around, to have your camera so still and methodical is so interesting.
There is, yeah, exactly. The sequences, those sequences filmed where you're using a dolly, trying to, I mean, this is where I kind of was talking about the documentary feel almost.
Mm, okay,
The fly on the wall kind of thing. You're a member of the party in this instance.
Oh, okay, yes. No, I yes, you know what I mean? Yes,
like,
yes,
and
yes.
And the camera is moving in such a way, I mean, like,
It's not a passive camera. It's trying to put you in the
Yeah, you're a member of the party.
Yeah.
Watching this social struggle unfold.
Mm-hmm.
And you tend to not realize it because it's so well made.
Yeah, yeah.
The editing is fucking so well made.
The editing is the other thing that blew my mind.
Yeah. But you are just... You are... I mean, that was the most... We should explain that this sequence is when Schumacher has got a gun and he's running after Marceau for trying to have a go at
Lizette. Yeah, he's caught Lizette and Marceau kind of flirting and getting a little touchy-feely, and yeah. He has had enough of this, and... Yeah.
And you're really quite familiar with the mansion at this stage because, you know, we've been in the mansion for a while.
Yeah.
And now there's this wonderful sequence of vibrant movement. And... Yeah, the dollying, the panning while the dollying is occurring, and mm-hmm. the really awesome edits just ensure that it just makes you feel, without you even realizing, that you are a member of the party, kind of peering over walls,
yeah.
walking past people, trying to get through the crowd to get the a closer camera, look at the action.
The camera moves and turns as if it were a spectator's head turning and looking at what is going on. Mm. Like, yeah.
And I think that's such an achievement.
Yeah.
Especially in 1939.
Mm.
Because you don't realise. That's the magic.
Yeah, because... And it's that thing of, I suppose, again, going back to it being 2019 and us, you know, watching it now in a modern... As a modern audience, it's so well made that it doesn't look... it's not comparable to other 1930 films, really, that we've watched. It's more... methodical, assured, confident, just flat out modern in the way that it's presenting its images and the story, like the visual language and the editing. It's fucking phenomenal.
Yeah. We should mention the Wolf Crow video because it goes into the blocking, which is a really fascinating thing with the depth of field. But it also goes into that sequence, I believe.
Yes. Yeah. I do want to say, like, to me, the scene where I really kind of perked up and really started to pay attention was the hunt scene.
Mm-hmm.
That's to me where the visuals stepped up a notch. Like the beautiful slow tracking shots of like the party going through and hitting and like kind of stirring up all the rabbits and things. It was almost like something out of a Kubrick film. Like just this very slow in these like sparsely treed like little forest thing. It was amazing to watch.
There's dolly shots in that as well. Mm. And again,
that's what I mean. Like outside dolly shots that are so still and beautifully framed with every character perfectly positioned in movement and things.
It makes you feel like, again, you don't realize it, but it makes you feel like you're a part of the hunting team.
Yeah.
And that's what's so engaging.
It reminded me, I like was sitting there watching it and I was like, this looks, I almost want to do like a side-by-side comparison of that scene with some of the stuff from Roma, Alfonso Cuarón's film from last year. Like, there are giant sequences that, like, similar to, like, wooded outdoor area and things. That is that slow, methodical panning shot that I'm like, this is 100% where Cuarón got that, like, influence for Roma from. Like, this is nuts. And because that also has a giant... That is, the film is just almost essentially his rules of the game. It's an upper class, lower class kind of struggle throughout it. And a year in the life of, like, a... Yeah. But it's... Just watching it, I was like, Jesus Christ. Like, that's... I now get the influence that this film has had on other filmmakers. You can definitely see it like, mention the scene without saying Kubrick. Like, I already did. It's
Yeah,
you can see very much so that he is essentially cutting a path through the jungle that is going to be like this wonderful kind of almost operatic still use of blocking and framing and character movement, kind of all mingling them together into this one weird, beautiful mess.
I think the hunting sequence, there's two of them.
Mm.
And I think the first one...
Yes.
Or both of them. But the first one, when it occurred, well, my interest perked up considerably.
And I think it's because it's so visually different to what had happened previous. Like, up until that point of when we get to the chateau, it's very much seeming like we're in sound stages and, like, you know, just mansion-y sets and things. And you're like, yeah. But seeing him employ the same precise visuals with where he's placing his camera in an outdoor setting where he can't control the lighting, he can't control the environment, yet he's still managing to do that is nuts.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a lot of those I mean, they're kind of oneers, right? They're
oneers. Yeah. It's a, like, it's a good 20-minute sequence, at least, the whole hunting stuff. And it's just beautiful.
There's a sequence where Robert unveils his... He's a collector of musical instrument machines.
Yeah.
Like those self-playing kind of
things.
Anyway, he unveils his new one that's huge and it's amazing in front of all these people at the party. And there's this really amazing one where it's moving through the room back and forth and, you know, characters are interacting and moving away out of frame and going to the back of the frame and the forefront. And, yeah, it's like you do not expect to see this kind of thing.
Mm.
In even a 1940s or 50s film.
And also how he lets that scene play out where it's Robert so proud of this prize piece in his collection and he turns it on and the crowd's like, oh, cool. And then it just keeps going and it keeps cutting back to Robert seeming less and less proud and enthused with his prized item when he's realizing like not everyone has the same reaction and feelings that I do towards these. It's so... interesting and like says so much about that character in this
one. Sympathetic, yeah.
Yeah,
which is important for the ending.
Yes, yes. How'd you find the ending? Like, on that note,
okay, so the ending is a series of unfortunate events that
you know, Lemony Snicket.
Exactly. Well, it felt like that.
It's a Lemony Snicket.
It felt like that, which is odd because. You know, you're going, as you say, from these great wonders and these great dolly shots and the hunting sequence and all that sort of stuff. And then it kind of, once Schumacher starts running around with his gun, trying to shoot Marceau, it shifts into...
farce.
Yeah.
Almost like a beautifully shot Fawlty Towers.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Also because he kind of looks like John Cleese. He's like a big, tall, lanky dude. Yeah.
And then there's this series of unfortunate events where someone else is wearing another person's coat and occasions and people are mistaken for another person and, you know, Schumacher.
We won't spoil it in case you haven't seen, I guess, but, it...
We usually spoil. Okay. I was about to spoil.
Okay, spoil. Spoil away.
I'm not going to spoil now.
Okay. You know what to spoil?
I know spoil.
But yeah, I found that ending, I guess, a little... lackluster for me, like, okay. Yeah.
Maybe we've got to dig deep, though. Again, like, this film, that's what it feels like. It's, you watch it, and it, or, something I mean, feels lackluster, like and then you go into it, and you find
it's,
that it's actually...
It's not. Like, I mean, in terms of, like, and I'm meaning lackluster in terms of, like, the base romantic story, like, love triangle-y elements of it. In terms of what it's saying socially and politically, like, it's not politically, the kind of social structures of it all, that works 100% because it is essentially a upper class being mistaken for a lower class being shot and then it by a lower class who and then
you just bought it.
Yeah. But I didn't get into specifics of names.
Yeah, but the someone was shot, you're spoiled.
Yeah, okay. what you gonna do? But yeah, you know, it is that thing and it very clearly is stating like we're all the, like it's that thing of like there is no difference between these, like it is, yeah, you can mistake one from the other just as easily, like yeah, and that works for like the overall statement, but in terms of the actual story I found it a little bit
yeah, okay,
yeah, but that's just me, but at the same time that's not really like what I gather Renoir's going for. He's not trying to,
but I think you just made the best point about that when you said that it's the great leveler.
Yeah, it is.
If
yes.
you're mistaken for another class,
that's it.
There's
like,
no
that's,
difference.
Yeah,
right?
that's it.
So, but even in death, there's no difference. Right?
Yeah, but that's like the overall giant statement the film is making, and like what he's trying to do with the film. So it's very successful in that regard. But in terms of like solving the love triangle-ness of it all, I found it wholly unsatisfying.
Okay,
but that's
I'm not.
But I'm like,
in
but
this,
I'm asterisking that as like, yeah. But that's not the point.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't care that it's not wrapped up in a nice little package.
Yeah, neither am I. Like, but yeah, because that's not the point. Like, that's not what he's doing with the film, and it's not supposed to. Yeah, this film isn't supposed to end on a happy note, I guess. So. Yeah. I know I've been watching a lot of romantic comedies lately. That's probably why I'm like, oh, he didn't. They didn't run away and meet at the top of the Empire State Building.
All seven of them could have just gotten a big pile.
Yeah, just orgy it, man.
Yeah.
Like, you've got the mansion. Like, if this had ended, like, full Eyes Wide Shut, like, bong, yeah. Like,
that ended all, well as well.
They had a masquerade ball and everything. They could have just gone for it.
Yeah. That's how again, modern people solve their
again,
problems.
Like, I'm going to say it. Kubrick, like, very influenced by this film. Yeah. I know, well, like, I think we eventually got there. Is there anything you think we've missed, or...
Yeah, there's fucking loads of shit we missed.
Yeah. Will you go back to this film, do you reckon?
I rarely go back to films. The only films that I rewatch and rewatch and rewatch that are old are spaghetti westerns.
Like, a classic, like, warm blankety films. But this is
one... I don't know, it's a fucking... The more you learn about it, the more... I'm sure that if I rewatched it again, it would be magnitudes of 10 times better.
Yeah, and you'll be picking up new and interesting stuff. That's because I have an urge to kind of go back and revisit this to try and pick up on all these things that I missed the first time around, and I've only kind of been able to crack the nut of this film, like, after digging deep, and now I'm like, okay, I've put in that initial legwork, let's go back in and do a second viewing and see how we go.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm not a filmmaker, but if I was a filmmaker, it is certainly worth trying to pull ideas out of to make your own films.
And just look at, like, just for staging and blocking and of actors and characters and camera alone, just to...
Yeah.
It's a masterclass in that. Yeah.
I can see why everybody really fucking enjoys it. Really thinks it's an extremely important film.
Mm. All right, well, on that note, trivia time?
Sure.
All right. So as we kind of alluded to earlier, when the film opened in 1939, initial reception of it was so bad that one audience member lit a newspaper and tried to burn the theatre that it was playing in down.
I heard about that. I don't believe that.
There were even threats to other theatres, apparently.
I know that people also wanted to smash seats, and maybe some of them did, but burning a newspaper is pretty extreme.
Mm. That's a impassioned response.
Yeah. I mean, like, you gotta be fucking angry.
Just get up and leave. Don't. Yeah.
But that's a different time as well, isn't it?
Yeah, that's like people were like, yeah.
Let me put it this way, right? In 1939, you think ticket prices for films today is expensive?
Yeah,
it's fucking expensive back then, and you would only have middle to upper class going there.
And also, it's cinema. On the, like, you know, 1939, like, it is, you know, socio-political tensions are at an all-time high. Like, shit is tense between, like, classes, and there's certain people, like, putting clear delineation lines between who is proper and who is not. And
yeah, it's... Actually, on that note, the hunting sequences, I watched the intro, like, some other stuff about Renoir talking about it, and how the hunting sequences is supposed to be a kind of look at the World War.
Kind of culling and...
Yeah, I mean, like, a kind of blatant disregard for life.
Yeah, because that goes on for a while actually showing lots of rabbits.
That's right. And the upper class, blatantly just slaughtering all these rabbits. I don't know... I mean, it kind of...
There's no moral ambiguity, and there's no question of... And no seeming remorse or, like, even acknowledgement of that they're taking a life. They're just so blasé about it.
And in my readings, this is just a side note, but in my readings, when I was reading about the film, the hunting sequence, people were saying that it was a kind of look at upper class treating the working class or soldiers, specifically soldiers in the wars, as a kind of fodder.
Okay.
And not really giving them the due respect that you would a life, another human.
Yeah.
And that those sequences were there to kind of illustrate that.
That's interesting.
But, that's...
Again, that's like...
It's like
reading into subtext
stuff.
And... Yeah.
It's film historian stuff. I don't know. Like, so...
And it's, again, one of those things of, like, context and knowing what he was going for and what, like, time and place and all of that. Stuff.
It's kind of over my head a little bit, but I still find it interesting that you can think about that. Again, like, this is what the film is you watch the film and then you dig deep and you find it, like, fucking really interesting shit to think about.
Little nuggets in there, yeah.
Anyway.
Well, despite being considered by historians now as one of the best films ever made, the picture almost became a lost art. Claiming that it was bad for morale of the country due to the impending war, the French government banned the film about a month after its original release. When Germany took over France the following year, it was banned by the Nazi Party as well, who also burnt many original prints. Allied planes then accidentally destroyed the original negatives. It was thought to be a lost picture. In 1956, some followers of director Jean Renoir found enough pieces of the film scattered throughout France to reconstruct it with Renoir's help. Renoir claimed that one minor scene from the original cut was missing.
Okay.
Interesting, fun story, right? The fact that the movie was almost lost during the war is a myth. I took you on a journey there, you see. These, like, countering kind of arguments of, like, what is, like, the weird history of this film. It was actually the extended version of the film that was lost. The original movie was shown in 1939. It was 113 minutes, or maybe a little bit more. That was the version that was a huge failure in things. He then cut it down to 100 minutes, and then again down to 90 minutes. And,
the seven-minute intro that he goes through, he's clearly really was upset.
Yep.
That the reception to his film was so controversial, he didn't really intend that.
Yeah.
And so he heavily cut it.
Yes. So Renoir cut it down to approximately 100 minutes, and then again to 90, and then there's an 85-minute cut that showed it as, like, kind of two little mini-films almost. It was these 23 minutes that were thought to be lost during World War II bombings. The situation remained unchanged until as late as 1958, where one of the original rushes were discovered, and the long version was reconstructed back to 110 minutes, which is what we all know today.
So the destruction wasn't... I mean, it was...
It was only of that initial 20... Like, that stuff that was cut down from the initial version.
Okay.
Yeah, so it wasn't the whole film. It was just a 23-minute portion that people were then in the 50s able to work with Renoir to reconstruct back to his original kind of 110-minute version.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that was a journey.
Yes. Do you want to hear another myth?
Sure.
There's a lot of myths around this one. It's almost like story time. Jim Henson's the storyteller. The fact that the film was a complete failure when it came out is also partly a myth.
But I heard that someone burnt a fucking newspaper in the theatre.
Yeah, I told you that a couple of minutes ago. Don't believe everything you hear on a podcast.
I didn't believe it. I tell you right now, I didn't believe that.
Renoir himself thought it was a complete flop, but he was impressed by a few hostile reactions, which included fights and allegedly a man trying to set fire to a theatre, as we've just mentioned. Attendance was low, but it was summer, and there were political tensions with Germany, and probably the public was put off with the turmoil about the movie. The critics were fairly balanced, actually. It wasn't a, oh my god, this is trash. It was like a fairly even kind of, you know, let's put it like maybe a 68% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay. But even then, I mean, like, you'd think that critics could get above wartime problems. Mm. Maybe not, I guess.
Yeah.
Not.
Apparently, like, some people went back and looked into it, and a study showed that one-third were positive reviews. One-third were negative reviews, and one-third abstained from actually reviewing the film because of the kind of controversial nature of it. The movie was then banned during World War II because what we mentioned earlier, and
is that because
as were other films as well, so it wasn't just specifically this one. It was...
Okay. So the reason that it's... So it's banned during wartime.
Mm-hmm.
So is that... So people were seeing the hunting sequence?
No, it's because of the class structure stuff.
Okay.
Like, yeah, in particular, like, the French government were like, we don't exactly want to be riling people up right now.
That's right.
And then Germany came in and took over France, and we're also like, we definitely don't want to fucking say that we're equals with lower class.
Like, you don't want to have, like, a social civil struggle.
Yeah. But yeah, so that's the kind of weird histories and stories behind...
It's amazing, isn't it? That the people, the governments would say, this is breaking the morale...
So we need to show this.
Yeah.
That it's nuts that happens, like, still occasionally to this day, that some films still get banned. Like, Australia's a weird country where stuff still gets banned here.
Yes.
Despite, like, yeah.
Yes. That's right.
Like, I think the ban on Salo was only lifted a couple of years ago, actually. Like, late 2000s.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and like, but that movie's pretty gnarly, but, yeah, that got, like, that was banned for ages, and then, like, yeah, Clockwork Orange was banned until, like, the 99 or something, like, yeah, 98, 99, like, yeah.
Yeah, I knew about that one.
And that's one where you watch that film now, and you're like, how do you not get it?
Yeah.
Like, how do you ban this, but you don't ban, like, say, Taxi Driver or something? It's like, what do you do? Like,
and how can you not trust the public to try and...
decipher that it's, like...
allow them to watch that film and figure it out.
Yeah, it's like trying to, like, yeah, just not understanding a satire and thing. Yeah.
Australia's really incredible. I've been fucked off for ages on
yes.
censorship.
But anyway, again, jumping back to the rules of the game, as we've mentioned often in this episode, it is considered to be one of the great films of all time. It's the only film that has ever been in the top 10 of the Sight and Sound recurring poll of the greatest films of all time. In 1952, it was ranked as number 10. Number 3 in 1960, like this, the Sight and Sound poll is every 10 years. That was the one that kind of happened recently, actually, in 2012. But yeah, so it's progressively gone from number 10 to number 3, number 2, 2, 2, 3, 4, like kind of jumping around a bit, but it's the only one that's consistently been in the top 10 throughout that whole history.
Huh.
Mm. It was chosen by Premiere Magazine as one of the 100 films that shook the world in the October 98 issue. They also listed it as the most daring movie ever made. Ranked number 5 non-English speaking film in the critics poll conducted by the BBC in 2018. Included in the Toronto Film Festival's Essential 100 Films Ever Made, and Roger Ebert considered it one of his great films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm.
Of course he did.
So, much lauded and loved film, and I get why, and I just need to watch it again to really get why.
Yeah, I think the film, I think half the fun of the film or enjoyment or engagement of the film is just learning about it historically and contextually.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, like, for me at this point, reversing time back to right when I finished the film, I have so much more appreciation.
Yeah. And I think my issue when I first watched the film was I was trying to grapple with the narrative levels of it and the character interplay and, like, what it's doing and saying as a story. Now that I've done the viewing of that, I want to go back and watch it on a purely technical level. Mm. And I think that's where the film really shines.
Yeah. Right on.
So I guess that'll probably wrap us up for Jean Renoir's The Rules of the Game.
It will.
What are we going to do next week for our next episode?
Oh, yes.
We've got an option here. I'm gonna put this to you. We can either do the next spy number, which is Yasujirō Ozu's Tokyo Story, which is a fucking amazing film.
Okay.
Or we can do something we talked about several weeks ago.
Yes.
And go on our first request.
Yes. This is my own request as well.
Yes.
Only because I hate that episode that we did a while back on Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, so...
And I want to revisit and update our catalogue of discussions about movies. Let's do... I've heard fucking amazing things about Tokyo Story. Let's do Silence of the Lambs, though.
All right.
Just so that it's out there and everybody knows what we're doing. The requests.
Yeah, we've got to jump in and do them one of them at some point because there's a few we want to kind of re-tackle. So, yeah. All right.
So the request is all about we're going to revisit old films that we've done podcasts on previously in the collection, and if anyone thinks we need to revisit and rethink and reanalyze for whatever reason. We're happy to entertain that idea.
Very much so. Yeah, we'd love to hear some suggestions from you of, you know, episodes you thought we...
fucking missed the point completely.
Yeah, like, especially early on, like, you know, we're, you know, well over 200 film, like, you know, we're balls deep into the collection at this point. So I think we've got a better understand. Like, the one, like, you threw out, like, when you came up with this idea, you threw out Silence of the Lambs, because that is just a definition of a clusterfuck episode.
Yeah, that's not necessarily, I want to revisit it because I didn't understand it. It's because I want
a good episode on Silence of the Lambs.
A good discussion to actually be had, not just a drunken rambling mess of like six people on mic and
Yeah, exactly.
Back early, and that's like episode 12 or something before we even knew what, like, you know, really what we were doing.
Working out the format, that's right.
And I want to go back and do like a Seventh Seal now that we've done a shitload of Bergman to try and go back to our first one and see if we can kind of analyze and get more out of that, because I know initially we were kind of like, eh.
We didn't get it because you got to understand Bergman.
Yes, and now I feel we actually do. Like, when we have a Bergman film, like, I'm like, okay, cool, what are we getting this time? Like,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the point of request. So, yeah, we'll do a request next.
Nice. All right, we'll keep an ear out for that in the next fortnight. That'll be dropping. We'll try and get that one in within the next couple of days, because I'm actually... It might be a week or two late. We'll see how we go. I'm heading off on my honeymoon. So.
Yay, congratulations.
Yeah, I've been married for a while now. It's just late, like, actually finding time and money to go and do that.
Honeymoon's a big deal.
Yes, it is, yeah. So if that episode's, like, a week or two late, that's the kind of explanation as to why, because
Chris edits.
Yeah, because I don't want to be, like, sitting at, like, the bar in Hawaii and actually just be like, no, I gotta put in sound drops. Yeah. But, again, thanks for listening, everyone. Hopefully you enjoyed our discussion rules of the game. I think we got there eventually. It's a tough nut to crack. But, again, thanks for listening. You can send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com. Please feel free to follow us on Facebook at Criterion Quest. You can, just search that and you'll find us. I'm going to put up links to the Wolf Crow video and Renoir talking about the film and, like, all the kind of little clips we've mentioned. I'll post them there. Or you can follow me on Twitter at Criterion Quest. Otherwise, we'll see you in a fortnight's time, or a little bit longer than a fortnight, depending, for Silence of the Lambs. But for this week's episode, I'm Chris.
And I'm Tom. See you next time.